Hello, and welcome to the Weekly Comic Spotlight on the Comic Book Page podcast. My name is John Mayo.
And I'm Bob Bretall. In this episode, we'll be discussing recently released comics. One from DC, one from Marvel, and at least one other. As always, we'll keep major spoilers to a minimum, but we'll discuss general plot points and storylines of the comics we review.
This is Weekly Comics Spotlight 202 for comics originally released on June 22nd, 2011. Starting us off in DC is Superman 712 or Krypto Number 1. Take your pick. This is yet another fill-in issue during the Grounded storyline that started back in 701 of Superman and should have finished up around this time. This is, what, the third fill-in they've had?
I haven't really been keeping track. Remember, I dropped Superman for several, you know, probably six issues while Straczynski was doing it solo, and picked it back up when Roberson came on board. And of course, even though this was solicited as a Roberson issue, it's not. It's Kurt Busiek, who's a fine writer, and Rick Leonardi with inks by John Sibal. And it's basically kind of a, I mean, it's a fine story, but it's essentially just a throwaway Krypto story.
Well, I mean, it's funny because we're getting to the point where, you know, we know they're rebooting, relaunching, doing a whole bunch of retrenching and revectoring, rebranding of the DC Universe. And I'm thinking not only, wow, is this another fill-in issue, just kind of in the depressed sense. And you're right, it's not a bad story. But around this time of Crisis on Infinite Earths back in the day, it's like, okay, they had a little bit before Man of Steel. What do? They gave us Whatever Happened to the Man of Tomorrow. I mean, that was the story that ended the pre-crisis Superman run. Classic stuff. Now, this issue aside, we're getting the Grounded story arc that's been going on forever and a day of Superman pacing the USA. Plus fill-in issues. Again, I like this one, but as far as a strong note to end any kind of an era of Superman on, this isn't cutting it. So, a bit disappointed with that. Now, this story takes place a little after the death of Superboy in Infinite Crisis, while Superman is just missing. I forget exactly where he was at the time. What I did appreciate here is they had some nice quick flashbacks throughout the issue to help get us back into that time period. Because it may have only been, what, 4 or 5 years ago? But long enough ago that it's like I couldn't remember where things had left off. And this is very much a Krypto story. I mean, hardly anyone else shows up except in flashbacks. It's not a bad Krypto story. And, you know, there were one or two things I loved, particularly the page where Krypto sees the bird, then the plane, then nothing. And it's like, okay, nice callback without, really, when you've got a character you can't do any dialogue for, it's kind of hard to do some of the classic shtick. But they managed to do it. Overall, while I enjoyed this story and thought it was good, it was incredibly light reading and felt so much like blatant filler material. Good filler material, and good light reading. But, you know what I mean? It left me a little wanting in those regards.
I've been reading, and it's like a comment, not specifically about this issue, but, and maybe it's just because I've been so immersed in looking at what's coming out in a couple of months with DC 2.0, but it just seems like almost all of the DC books lately are just marking time until the end. You know, it's just like, you know, let's wrap up. Let's, you know, it's like people at work, like the week before they're going on vacation. They don't want to, like,
Yeah, I mean,
they don't want to, like, start anything up. You know, it's just, everything just seems like it's meandering around. And, you know, boy, I mean, I know I'm, maybe it's making me even more excited. I mean, I'm liking the Flashpoint stuff a lot. But the Flashpoint stuff is leading into the relaunch. The rest of the DC Universe is almost like, if I didn't read any more of it, I don't think I'd feel, personally, I don't think I'd feel like I'm missing anything.
Well, you know, it's funny you mention that, because you're right. This is kind of a very odd transition point for reading DC Comics right now. We've got the What's Going Away, titles like this that are, like you said, marking time, wrapping things up, where really they've got the opportunity, knowing that they're going to relaunch and in some cases reboot the characters. I mean, they could have been killing characters left and right, doing an oh my god kind of thing every issue of a lot of these titles, and they're not. which is a little, it's like, okay, again, giving that feeling of marking time. The fact that we know the whole DC 2.0 lineup is coming predisposes us to be thinking that, whether the material really warrants that. The fact that it's not actively fighting against that expectation is part of the problem. And then we've got that interesting Flashpoint stuff kind of right in the middle. It's not what's old, it's not what's next, it's what's now. And it's really good stuff for the most part. And it's one of those that it's definitely coloring my opinion of the DC Comics I'm reading right now.
Well, I mean, I could just be reading the Flashpoint stuff and be happy. I mean, I pre-ordered a lot of this other stuff, and it's like, I don't even feel like reading a lot of it. I mean, you have the War of the Green Lanterns coming along, and the last part is delayed for weeks. They actually went ahead and shipped the Emerald Warriors issue this week. We'll get it in our DCBS
so
box
next week, next as week. Far as the week of right. comics we're talking
right.
about. Okay.
But, I mean, the point is that that's the epilogue to the War of the Green Lanterns, and it's coming out before the final part because that book is so delayed.
Wow.
And it's almost like a lot of these creators are probably so busy getting the new stuff ready that a lot of this, you know, what's coming out now is kind of backburnered or something.
Well, it's interesting because what I've heard, and maybe it was out of one of the retailer summits or whatever they've done recently promoting what's new at DC, in addition to saying we're not writing for trades, if it's a three-issue story, it's a three-issue story. We're not going to pad it to six issues or whatever. The other thing I'm hearing, though, and this goes to your point, is if people can't get stuff done on time, they'll replace them with somebody who can. So I think there's very much a push towards, you know, once the line is drawn and there's kind of that buffer zone with Flashpoint, but once that DC 2.0 lineup starts, they're at least telling us, whether they can live up to this or not, they're telling us things will come out on time, period. Or if something's late, that guy is, they're going to fix the problem. We're not going to have something like we've got right here with Superman, where for a 12-issue story arc, we've had multiple fill-in issues. You know, that I don't think they're going to allow to continue to happen. Now, there's not wanting to allow it and actually following through on that, which is, you know, easier said than done. But then, you know, I look back at CrossGen that went, what, 4 years without missing a ship date?
Yeah.
So.
Well, and then you have the standard, you know, argument that comes out when you bring something like that up, which is, okay, you know, so if person A, who's a good creator, can't get something done and they bring in creator B, is it going to compromise the work? You know, is it, you know, what's going to happen? It's
interesting because we had that discussion on the forum in regards to creator-owned properties, and I think it's a different ballgame between the two because the example there was non-player, and you can't have that without Nate Simpson, period.
Right.
Okay, Superman, you can have without Straczynski. Had it before, had it again, you know what I mean? So there's a certain amount of, you know, again, can they get it done on time, but a certain amount of professionalism, and particularly for a company like DC or Marvel that are big corporate entities, they can afford to build in a buffer. They can afford to get a couple issues in the can that an individual solo creator simply doesn't necessarily have that option with.
Right. And,
you know,
and
financially
maybe,
for.
Maybe what they need to do is when they're going to have a long story arc, you know, do some short stuff before, you know, that they might have some other creators on and let the creative team for the long story arc get it done before it starts coming out so that it's not going to get interrupted in the middle.
Yep.
And kill the story momentum. That would not compromise the story, you know, because like you said, you can take Superman and, you know, it just seems like this one was kind of rushed. When you have a Superman issue that doesn't have any Superman in it, and it's Krypto, I mean, again, fine story, but it's not what I'm looking for in an entire issue of Superman.
It's a,
you know,
backup
I'd rather
story.
See, yeah, I mean, I'd rather see a fill-in issue of Superman, you know, where he's doing something else, but it's a little harder to do that when you're inserting it in the middle of another Superman story as opposed to doing some of those little change of pace stories before the big story starts. And then make sure that the big story comes out on time because you've got it done before you start it.
Well, and the fact that this had absolutely nothing to do with the grounded storyline is a little annoying. How hard would it have been to have had a timeless Superman tale that had a framing sequence at the beginning of end of basically two reporters who've been following Superman across the country talking about the time they met Superman or something. Yeah. You know what I mean?
That's actually a good idea. You know, it's, and that would have worked a lot better than this issue in the context, you know. And same thing with Green Lantern. I mean, going back to that, I mean, the movie's out 2 weeks ago, and you're not able to get the conclusion of War of the Green Lanterns out, you know, concurrent with the movie. I mean, there's something majorly messed up with that. The prequel, you know, for Sinestro was supposed to have shipped a month ago, and it's not now scheduled to come out for like another 3 or 4 weeks.
Wow. Yeah. Well, one of the things I'm taking out of Flashpoint is the fact that they can tell accessible stories, at least in all these first issues. We'll see how the second issues go. That build a big universe that have that larger canvas, that connected universe without the blatant tie-in and, oh, I've got to go follow this into this other title to make sense of it. So they can tell the shared universe kind of thing effectively and well. So I'm seeing that as kind of a trial run, if you will, for editorial shifts in philosophy and whatnot. I'm hearing the right things out of the higher-ups at DC. We're not going to force things to padded story arcs. We're going to try to get things out on time. You know, that I think, again, if they can pull off what they're trying to, the DC comics we're going to be talking about in a couple of months could just be a quantum leap of quality improvement over what we're getting now. Not that I think what we're getting now is bad. It's just scattershot. It lacks focus. It lacks cohesion. And in this case, it lacks being part of the story it was supposed to be. You know, it's an interesting time to read DC.
Well, or not to read DC. I mean, it's like, I think anyone who's not reading DC, I would recommend strongly, other than Flashpoint, against picking up any of the mainstream DCU books until the DC number ones come out in a couple of months. Because this is not, what you're seeing now just does not feel to me like a good example of what can be done with the DC books. It does really seem like a lot of marking time. And I think the Flashpoint stuff is interesting.
I think part of the marking time, though, not only because we're expecting the new stuff to be clean slate, which they're saying it will be, but because everything we're hitting right now is middle of a story arc. In some cases, because they've accelerated timelines or slowed timelines down in terms of release schedules. So if they had the normal assortment of a couple of things starting stories, a couple of things finishing stories, a couple of things in the middle, I don't think the feeling of marking time would be as pronounced. I think we'd certainly still be predisposed to be thinking that just because of the way they're marketing stuff. But, I mean, I've been saying for a while the whole what's next is really distracting from what's now, you know, in comics for a while. You know, they're so busy promoting the new thing that sometimes by the time it comes out, it feels like old news.
Yeah.
A good example of that, written by Kurt Busiek, was Power Company. They had done promotional art, released that a year before the thing came out, launched with 7 one-shots, then the first issue. So by the time you were at the third issue, you felt like you almost had read a year's worth of story. You know, so it already, it aged prematurely, I guess. So overall, with this issue, I really enjoyed it. I'm not going to say I really respected it, because I don't think it had the meat and potatoes, the substance I would have liked it to have. But for a fun crypto story, something that arguably could have been a 8-10-page backup story, but actually used the pages acceptably, you know, I'm going to give this a 4 out of 5. I thought it was good, but you know, I they can't go back to this well too often, if you know what I mean. You know, for a fill-in one-shot, it was good. It was enjoyable. Again, they put me back in that time era of the events effectively. So, you know, I give Busiek high marks for that. It was an effectively told story.
I give it a 3 out of 5. I felt like it was, like I said, it was marking time. It was just an obvious fill-in, and that definitely colored my perception of it. And I think it affected my enjoyment as well.
I can understand that, and I can't disagree with any of those points, because it was blatantly marking time and filling an issue. Hopefully we'll not see that again from DC for quite some time after the new number ones.
Now, next up, we've got Secret Avengers number 14. From Marvel, we've got Fear Itself invading the Secret Avengers title, which has been going along pretty good up to this point. I felt that this issue was a real change up, you know, in that it focused almost exclusively, well, I mean, it didn't even focus on Valkyrie. It's almost like Valkyrie was an incidental character to the story, but she was the only one of the Avengers in it. It was mostly these people, and I guess they're supposed to be in the Air Force, although they've got kind of...
I thought they were kind of the S.H.I.E.L.D. people or whatever. It's
hard to tell.
They've
got kind of ambiguous markings on their uniforms. Maybe they're like kind of on a helicarrier. Whatever they are, they don't appear to be wearing S.H.I.E.L.D. uniforms. You know, they're kind of military, kind of not. But, I mean, this one was another one. It was just like... It felt like one of those, you know, kind of change of pace issues that it didn't work that well for me. It was a fine, you know, it was an okay story. I see the point that was trying to be made here, and it was supposed to tug at my heartstrings and give me a little bit of, you know, background into the Valkyrie character. But, you know, I would have rather seen some action in this with a few more of the Secret Avengers in it.
Again, I can see where you're coming from, and I'm starting to wonder if maybe I was just in a unusually good frame of mind when I was reading a couple of these issues. I thought this was really good. I thought Nick Spencer, the writer, did a great job on this issue. This is set in the overall Fear Itself story arc, like you said, but this had an actual personal feel to it. And part of it is those two characters that we're introduced to in that first scene. They're used, I thought, very effectively to ground us in this story and to give us a connection to it. And, you know, it's funny, because until you mentioned it, the blatantly ambiguous military-ish uniforms hadn't even registered to me, and I'm sitting here flipping through it, and it's like, I have no idea. Are they military? Are they not? What the hell? You know, that's the sort of thing that in other cases it probably would have popped out and just driven me nuts. Why aren't they in S.H.I.E.L.D. uniforms or whatever? Didn't faze me at all. Because I felt we got to know enough about these two characters to know them to some degree, to care about them to some degree, which I thought was essential for this story to work, at least in my opinion. We needed the quote-unquote locals to ground the story, make it personal, and connect to things. And they were very much a kind of a parallel story to the backstory we get on Valkyrie. And her relationship with Sigmund was quickly and effectively set up. That, too, is an essential part of the story for how things have to land at the ending. And I thought there were a couple of good character moments for Valkyrie. Nothing that's a, oh my gosh, you know, defining moment or whatever. And you're right, maybe this wasn't, you know, heavy on the action or whatnot. But it had a couple of good splash panels, a couple of, you know, good action poses or whatever. You know, I loved her little pep talk, which, you know, I certainly wouldn't want to hear if I'm about to go into battle. But, you know, can't get it on inaccuracy. I thought this as a change of pace kind of an issue. Again, this is not the kind of thing you can go back to this well too often on a title. It set up Valkyrie's character. It gave us some good backstory on her. It gave us a connection to her. It did it through a couple of characters that normally would have been just walk on, who the hell are they, why should I care, walk off characters. You know, it worked for me. And I think that's a tribute to Spencer's writing, because it's not like it's an inherently brilliant kind of a story. It was just well told, at least for me. So for me, this was a very solid 4 out of 5 and a good, very done-in-one kind of a story. Now, would I like to see more of the other Secret Avengers, a lot more action and stuff next issue? Certainly. But for a good, you know, breather kind of a change of pace issue, particularly for something that's tying into this overall expansive Fear Itself monstrosity, having something that was a very focused character story, you know, I was impressed with.
Yeah, that's a perfectly valid opinion. I was not as taken with it. I give it a 3. Again, I was just, maybe I was in a frame of mind that, you know, I wanted to read something with a little bit of pep, and both of these issues just kind of were there, you know.
Well, I think it's very much a mood issue. I mean, I was in the right mood for these. There are other times I would have read these and thought, you know, what the hell, crypto, that's it? You know, and this one, it's like, you know. So I can see where you're coming from.
Now, taking that turn, because I read the next one kind of right after those two, we're going now to IDW with John Byrne's Next Men number 7 as the story continues. I mean, there's no big set piece in this. And thematically, I can't see that it's that far different from Secret Avengers. You know, it's mostly character development and, you know, there's no big fight scenes or anything like that. Yet I really liked this issue. And maybe that's because the frame of mind that I'm in when I'm reading Next Men is expecting this kind of a story. Whereas, you know, when I'm reading Secret Avengers, I want to see, especially, you know, I want to see him thumping something or something. I don't know.
I think there were some significant differences between the two stories, at least from my perspective. This was one of the first times that Byrne was really kind of pulling the group back together or starting to do that here. And whereas with both the Superman thing where it was focused solely on Krypto, with the Secret Avengers where, yeah, we had some of the characters, but it was focused thematically very much on Valkyrie. Here, we get pretty much most of the team. We've got a lot of characters, and I'm finding this series to be a little challenging in so much as putting all the pieces together, because there's a lot going on here. I mean, the majority of this issue made perfect sense to me, but there are a couple of things, particularly that reveal at the end, that lacked a little bit of power for me, because I couldn't put it into context. I'm like, so who was that again? You know? And, you know, with Byrne, there are a couple of things that, I mean, his art style is distinctive. On books he is writing, and books particularly he is creating and the driving force on, I find it to be a wonderful blend of his writing, his art. The whole thing just jives together beautifully. I loved the little technobabble bit with the displacement suits. I mean, those just look like fun tech. They're highly functional in terms of a story use. Kind of Doctor Who-ish with the whole chameleon field aspect, but hey, I enjoyed those couple of panels. It was, you know, expository dialogue and something that you didn't absolutely have to have in the issue, but it was fun. It worked. And it was John Byrne-ish, if you know what I mean. You know, I'm really curious kind of what's going on near the end where the power seems to cut out a little bit for a couple of people. And overall, while I'm really enjoying this series, I got a feeling it would work a hell of a lot better for me if I read the issues not only back-to-back, but probably did so after rereading the original series. Because there's a lot of meat and layers and subtlety and backstory to this series. I certainly would not categorize it as the light reading that I think that Krypto story was. And I think the Valkyrie one in Secret Avengers had some depth to it, but not the breadth or the scope that this has.
Well, I think the difference there is that there's no context you need to bring to either of those other two stories.
Yes.
Everything that you need is right there in that story. And there's a lot in this Next Men issue that is outside of this issue that if you don't have a certain amount of context, you know, you're reading along through this and it's like, you know, what? A big question mark over your head, you know, if you're drawn in a comic. I think that this book in particular has got a very limited appeal to just a fan base in general. I mean, I think this is a series that for someone just wandering in off the street and picking it up, while I really like the series, I think it's relatively inaccessible.
I certainly would agree that this
standard,
is not,
you know, person.
Yeah, this is not for a casual fan. I cannot imagine dipping your toe into this title. Either you're in it or you're not.
Yeah, I mean, but, you know, if you're in it, I'm kind of following along with it. And like you said, I mean, there are certain parts of it that I don't completely have perfect recall on, but I have enough remembrance and enough context that I'm enjoying it as I read through it. And it's mostly just the Byrne-iness of it, you know? It's just, I like when he tells this kind of story. And, you know, this is obviously, there's a lot of John Byrne storyteller in this. This is a book that is for fans of John Byrne. And if you're not a fan of John Byrne, you know, stay clear. You know, it's, you know, I can't imagine someone who doesn't like John Byrne picking up a book that's got John Byrne, you know, emblazoned on the cover anyway. So, you know, it's probably self-policing in that respect. I think, though, and a lot of people that are Byrne fans have probably read, you know, the previous run, even if, you know, they haven't read it recently. You have at least some context for it.
Yeah, I guess part of it is that original run was so many years ago that I recall that I read it, and I don't really recall the experience of reading it, if you know what I mean. So there are a couple of things where he's writing at a higher level, but for a more attentive reader than I think a lot of comic writers are. And there are a couple of things where I don't know that I would necessarily need footnotes saying go back to this issue or whatever, but let's just say the Wikipedia article on John Byrne's Next Men was not sufficient help for me to recall one or two things that I just needed something to kind of jog my memory. And again, it's how long ago I read the material.
This is a book that would actually benefit very strongly from having some footnotes and maybe a context-setting article or even a little backup with a reprint of some of the stuff that, you know, kind of revisits things from the original run that are played upon in the current issue to jog people's memory, because it has been 10-plus years, right?
When I was watching Babylon 5 back when it was originally on television, I watched the first season. I liked it. It was good, a little dry, whatever. Second season, things started to heat up. I liked it. What really kind of was a defining moment for me with that series was not just that it started getting really good, but around that time, I found The Lurker's Guide to Babylon 5. It was a website that for every episode had kind of a, hey, did you notice this? There's this. This happened back here. You need to remember this. Note where this ties in. And it was kind of the DVD extras. Something where, you know, they did the digging. They had some theories of, hey, we think this might be where this is going, or this might pan out this way, and things to contemplate, to conjecture about, whatever. There are not that many stories out there, be it in TV or comics, that I think have the narrative depth for that kind of a thing. This is certainly one of them, though, because I think there's a lot of, you know, material presented on these. These are very word-heavy pages, but not in a rambling sense, in a crap. He's cramming a lot of story onto these pages. And there's a lot of, okay, well, what do we think happened with this? Why do we think this person did this? What's the origin of the displacement suit, or how could it be used? Or, you know, there's a lot of discussion points, I guess might be a good way to put it, in any one of these issues. Add up the 7 of this, the 30 or whatever in the previous one, and I mean, there's just there's a lot there, and I really got to commend Byrne for doing that. But not having access to something where that homework's been done for me, it can be a little frustrating to be reading this, knowing there's something that if I could just remember who so-and-so was or what happened back at this point, you know, a light bulb would turn on for me and I'd get just that added level of enjoyment.
Right. And I guess it's been 17 years since the last series. It was was there something in between? Because the original series ended in December of 94. I just looked it up. Maybe there was one that happened in between there somewhere.
I'm not sure. There was the 21-12 one-shot, which I think is part of this narrative world. But the 3 in Superscript on the cover is to kind of denote volume 3, but I don't recall a middle volume.
Yeah, I'm not finding anything here, because that 21-12 happened, I guess this ended December of 94, and 21-12 happened in 1992, so it happened during the run of the original one.
Yeah.
Although maybe they countered it as like a second one or something like that.
I'm not sure.
Yeah, I don't know. But it's been a long time in any event since this other stuff came out. I mean, they did do that a couple of hardcovers reprinting this stuff.
And when this was starting up, they did a one either hardcover or softcover that had everything.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what I'm saying. In 2009, they reprinted 2 volumes that had a lot of this material. Not all of it. The first one looks like it actually started in Dark Horse Presents. So it has the Dark Horse Presents stuff and then the first 10 issues of the series. And then the second hardcover goes up through issue 20. So there would be a third hardcover to complete that out. Yeah, that I don't know that ever came out.
Again, I thought
probably due to low sales.
I thought before they launched this, they did one collected edition that had all 30 issues or whatever.
Oh, maybe.
So, I'm not sure I realized it started in Dark Horse Comics Presents. I'll have to see if I have those issues. Again, I love this stuff. I like Byrne when he's doing his stuff. I think it's been ages since he's really done anything for Marvel or DC that I thought, wow, that was just brilliant, shy of the Superman-Batman generation stuff. And really, I think the defining point at which he went from being really good for the majors to really not that good for the majors, in my opinion, was when he first did X-Men. I think once he started getting a taste for he could do pretty much whatever the hell he wanted in his book and it could stay true to his vision, I think that was a changing point for him in a good way.
Right. Okay. It looks like they didn't do it in hardcover, but they did a John Byrne's complete X-Men that were two softcover volumes that between the two of them, they reprinted the entire 30 issues plus the Dark Horse Presents issues, which were in issues 54 through 57 of Dark Horse Presents. Then that 2112 actually came between the Dark Horse Presents and the Next Men series proper.
Okay. For me, this was a low 4 out of 5. I thought it was really good, but there was kind of that nagging, crap, I know I'm missing something. That you know, for me, it still gets that 4, but it's hard for me to say, wow, it's a really solid 4. I think if he did a little bit better on the accessibility aspect, this is a series that could easily be a 5 out of 5. I mean, he's got the depth and substance there to support that.
So I gave it a 4 out of 5 also, not low. I mean, I gave it a solid 4 out of 5. I think that if all those things you talk about were actually in there, it would knock it up to a 5 for me.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that I would benefit from it as much as anybody, you know, just having those reminders. Because I do still enjoy it, but I also still have that nagging feeling of, you know, I'm missing something due to my faulty recollection of what happened all those years ago, in absence of wanting to dig out the issues and, you know, reread them, which I could do theoretically. So,
oh, I could certainly do it too. I guess the annoying part is I know he's been playing fair. I know that he's put the backstory in those back issues to make all of this make perfect sense and whatnot. And if this had been coming out on a monthly basis right after those earlier issues, probably wouldn't have any problem with it. But when this issue, or when this series restarted with that first issue, a lot happened, and it kind of opened on a, hang on, I'm still not quite sure what's going on, footing, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
So if you're looking for a series that's a little bit more challenging or stimulating, might be the right way to put it, in a good way of there's meat, there's something that, I don't want to say you've got to go dig for, but will reward an attentive reader, this is certainly a series worth checking out. Unless, of course, you have a pathological hatred for John Byrne's art, at which point, oh well.
Yeah. It's something that you really want to avoid in that event.
Yeah. On some other comics, Flashpoint this week had some interesting stuff. Did you read the Reverse Flash one?
Yes.
Was it just me, or does that seem to not have been a Flashpoint thing? Because it seems to have taken place in the timeline before Flashpoint changed everything.
It's also interesting that it's a one-shot, but the cover says one of three.
That is interesting. I hadn't noticed that. I'm going to start blaming the Reverse Flash for all of the things that are plaguing me these days, particularly having messed up the release of the Mayo reports this month and getting the April ones instead of the May ones. I fixed the links, by the way, people. But it's the Reverse Flash's fault.
Professor Zoom screwed that up. He messed with the timeline to throw you back in time to April.
Uh-huh. That's exactly what happened. He couldn't change much. He just flipped a 5 to a 4. It's all his fault. I'm still really liking what they're doing with Flashpoint. I get more and more impressed when I read something like that, Lois Lane and the Resistance, and I'm thinking, you know, we've already gotten the Amazon side of the story, the Atlantean side of the story, Grodd's side of the story, for that matter, and now with Lois Lane, we get more background information on some of the whole bit with the Amazons. It's like,
that was a really good issue.
They keep adding depth to this stuff. I keep getting a little more and more perplexed, though, when I read like the Outsider one, which I thought tied into the first issue of Flashpoint very effectively. But I'm getting confused as to what exactly changed in the timeline. Because some of the stuff goes back at least 40 years or something. Some of it seems to go out into space with what we'd seen in the Green Lantern issue.
Right.
So
and the thing that, well, One thing confused me, and I don't think it's that much of a spoiler, so let's talk about it. And that is, so Reverse Flash makes the point in that Reverse Flash one-shot that he can't just stop Barry Allen becoming the Flash, because if he doesn't become the Flash, then
he doesn't become the reverse Flash,
right? And he'll mess with himself. So he decides then to, you know, do the other stuff that he does to screw with Barry Allen. So then in Flashpoint number one, you know, Barry doesn't have his speed. He doesn't seem to be the Flash. There doesn't seem to have been a Flash. So what exactly happened there? And I'm sure, you know, well, we've only had the first issues. We don't have the whole story yet, but I'm going to be really interested to see how that pans out, because now they've kind of dropped that nugget, which makes perfect sense, you know, in all this time travel-y kind of way, that you can't just stop the Flash from becoming the Flash, because then you have that paradox where then you don't have the Reverse Flash to go back and, you know, think too hard about it.
It also goes back to that issue of the Flash we talked about a couple of months ago, where it was the Reverse Flash's origin, and he was editing his own timeline and doing it to, you know, to not have a brother and stuff like that. So I think there's some stuff, there's some specifics about how the, be it the negative speed force or whatever, work that'll have some very fine lines as to what he can and can't change. And hopefully we'll get that all kind of clarified.
Right.
Because it's definitely perplexing at times.
I was just scratching my head specifically to the point of, I can't stop Barry Allen becoming the Flash, yet nobody
seems to have done that, yeah.
Nobody seems to know who the Flash is in Flashpoint. So, you know, how are they going to reconcile that? And I'm sure they will. I just want to see how they do.
Well, I think he stopped him. He delayed him from becoming the Flash, but did not prevent him. So I think that obviously the resolution of Flashpoint is somehow going to center around Barry with his powers back and Booster Gold somehow doing something to sort of set things straight that once went wrong. But where is Sam Beckett and Quantum Leap when we need them, you know?
Yeah. That Booster issue was pretty good, too.
Yeah.
45.
Again, they're doing some good stuff over there. I'm finding the Flashpoint stuff to be very cohesive, very enjoyable, very layered and detailed and intertwined in a good way, and I'm not feeling that way with Fear itself.
Yeah. And, you know, like I said before, my advice, anyone who's interested in DC, don't have that much money to get everything, don't have that much time, chuck the regular DC books at this point and start checking out the Flashpoint books. I think they're a lot better done right now than the main books.
I really hope that's a sign of things to come.
Yeah.
That they've really, at DC, are taking a look at what's working, what's not, retrenching, and rethinking how they tell stories. You know, I think there's a definite possibility that what they're starting up with the new number ones could be some great, great stuff. I'll admit I've still got some concerns about the major changes they're making to their brands and their repositioning approach. Hopefully it works. I don't know.
That's all that I've got for this week.
Cool. We're done then.
Join us next week when we discuss Flashpoint, the Canterbury Cricket number one from DC, Ultimate Comics X number 5 from Marvel, and Rocketeer Adventures number 2 from IDW.
The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. Please email us at theguys@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening.